Welcome to another edition of The Informed Gardener with your host, Dr. Linda Chalker-Scott, associate professor and extension urban horticulturalist at Washington State University. And now, the science behind gardening with Dr. Linda.
Thanks for joining us again on the Informed Gardener podcast. That long-winded title you just heard means that I'm your garden science translator. I read articles on plant and soil science and then translate it so you can use it in your garden. So each week I'll stretch your mind a little bit by showing how you can use this great plant and soil science to save time, money, and natural resources. The information I share is always based on the best scientific research that either I or other university professors have conducted. And every week I try to follow some kind of fun theme. Today's theme is selling sustainability. I'm going to tell you why mixing it up in the garden is the best way to grow veggies, why some green products are anything but, and why an instant landscape will always turn into a permanent long-term disaster. We're also going to head outside to chat with Seattle homeowner Jim Scott to find out the challenges in building your own garden pond. And yes, the similarities in our last names are not just coincidental. But first, let's look at selling sustainability in the news. So what exactly is sustainability? It's one of those words that gets used and used and overused, and actually I really have started to hate the word. But it's a really useful word when we're talking about gardens. And I've come up with a three-part definition. We're going to look at all three of those parts in today's podcast. So let's go back several decades. And do you remember that one panel cartoon that was called Love Is... that came out in the late 60s? Well, that's how I'm going to introduce the three parts of sustainability in today's podcast. So when you hear sustainability is, then you're going to hear one of those definitions. Sustainability is discovering and nurturing the natural processes that keep your gardens and landscapes healthy and functional. And one of those processes is how plants interact with each other. So this first article comes from an online research file at University of California at Davis. And this is actually a rather old article. It was published 30 years ago. But good science transcends time. We can use this information now. We could use it 30 years ago. We can use it 60 years from now. It's great to have information like this to support all the anecdotal results that people get. And you have to have that science so that you can recommend it to others. So this is great quality research on something called polyculture. Now we're going to back up a little bit and talk about what monoculture is first. And what monoculture is when you plant something like a lawn or a field of corn or something where it's all one kind of plant. Even tree plantations are the same way. Douglas fir plantations, that's a monoculture of Douglas fir trees. And your lawn is some kind of Bermuda grass or some other type of commonly used turf, but it's all the same species. So this is what a conventional lawn looks like and a conventional field looks like, all one crop. And the reason they do this is because technology kind of dictates that we do this. And you have to think about it. When you're trying to water crops or fertilize them or harvest them, we always rely on technology now. We have machinery to do this. So the easiest way to do it is to have everything identical. And that way you can have rows of the same space, plants that need the same amount of water and fertilizer. It just makes it really easy to manage. But the problem is it's a very artificial system. And if you go back many hundreds of years, you'd find that we planted things in polyculture. Now, polyculture isn't growing parrots, although it kind of sounds like it, but it's actually just interplanting two or more species together, the same area, the same time. And a really classic example is something that Native Americans do, which is planting corn, squash, and beans all together. So they would take a kernel of corn, a squash seed, and a bean seed, and put them into a hole, and usually throw in a piece of fish as a fertilizer, and then have the crops grow. The reason this is so cool is because the corn grows very tall and it acts as kind of a ladder for the bean to grow on, because you know bean is a viney plant, needs support. So the bean kind of twirls around the corn, and then the squash grows very flat along the ground and actually is a living mulch. It shades the soil and it helps conserve water. All of these plants use water in different parts of the soil. They have different types of root systems and they really don't compete with each other. So it was a great way to grow three important food crops and really keep the weeds down and make sure they're using all the available water and nutrients. So now we're going to go again forward into time talking about monocultures. And if you have monocultures, then you're growing all corn or all beans or all squash. And what happens is that now you're creating something that's easy to harvest, but you're also creating a bug buffet or maybe a fungal food fest, because all of those plants are going to be some favorite food of some pest. And that means you're going to be spending a lot of time and energy and money on pesticides. So you don't really want to do that if you're trying to grow things sustainably. You want to go backwards in time and look at these polycultural methods. So this research that was done at Davis is so interesting because it really tested this hypothesis on whether or not growing plants together was better than growing them by themselves. So they did three different types of combinations. They did collard greens and bean greens together in one area. They grew Brussels sprouts and fava beans in another area. And then a third test was corn and cowpeas. And then they grew separate fields of just collards and just green beans and just Brussels sprouts, et cetera, to compare how much insect damage they had, to compare weed growth, to compare crop yield, all these things that are really important in terms of getting the biggest bang for your buck when you're planting vegetables. So we're just going to really look at the collards and the green beans to see what they found. Well, it turns out that collard greens are really susceptible to flea beetles and cabbage aphids. Those are the two of the big bug problems that that crop has. And when they interplanted the green beans along with the collard greens, they found out that the flea beetles were decreased. And part of this is because they think that the beetles were confused because their favorite food wasn't right next to each other for yards and yards and yards. And instead they kept on running into the beans, which they didn't eat. And so the bugs didn't do as well, didn't reproduce as well, less damage. They also found that there were more beneficial insects in these polycultures. And that's partially because you've got different types of plants there with different flowers, different types of food rewards, different places for insects to hide. And a lot of these beneficials are parasitoids, and those are ones that will lay eggs in pests, and then the larvae eat them from the inside out and kill them. So it's a great natural way of controlling insects. So obviously beneficial insects were one of the byproducts of this polyculture. The other thing they found was that weeds were reduced by polyculture too. And the reason is because collard greens are very slow growing, and so it gives weeds a really good opportunity to get the jump on them and start growing quickly. But when they put the green beans in, this is a much faster growing crop, and the soil was covered much more quickly and the weeds were kept out. So that's another benefit of polyculture. So when they tested all these things and looked at yields, and they looked at reduced weeds, and they looked at reduced pests, everything was positive compared to the monocultures. The big difference is labor. If you're going to do polyculture, it means you have to use a lot more labor. Much of this might have to be done by hand. Maybe you can't use machinery anymore. But when you think about it, especially in your own garden, labor is a sustainable resource because you're the one doing it. You can go right back out there, and after you've had some food, so you've gotten your energy back, you go back out there and you weed or whatever you need to do, and you're going to be using fewer resources, fewer pesticides, less fertilizer, have a healthier garden, and you'll be happier. So what do we learn from this information about monocultures and polycultures that is so important to sustainability? Well, remember, sustainability is discovering and nurturing those natural processes. One of the natural processes is how plants function with each other. And when we grow them together, we get a lot more benefits than growing them separately. My second news item comes from treehugger.com. And just for the record, I don't endorse .com sites. It just had some interesting information. It has a slideshow of their Sustainable Garden Starter Kit, 10 must-have products for the new green grower. So sustainability is choosing plants and products wisely to conserve natural resources. And this list of 10 actually has some good ideas. One of the very first things they mention is mulch, and you know how I feel about mulch, especially my favorite wood chips. And they do say that mulches are important for preserving soil health. They say that using locally produced materials, organic materials, are good. So this is a really good tip, and I would heartily endorse this. Anytime you can use local organic materials as a mulch, go for it. Another one of their good ideas was having a rain barrel. Now you can argue on how much water a rain barrel really captures and holds, but my opinion is something is better than nothing. So we actually have two rain barrels. And the whole issue here is, again, buy local and use recycled materials. So one of the things that I thought was interesting about this particular tip was they recommended a rain barrel that will cost you well over $100, plus you have to have it shipped in. What we did is we found a local guy who takes recycled olive oil drums, 80-gallon drums, and then retrofits them to collect water and then dispense it out of a spigot. So we got two of those, locally made, materials kept out of the landfill, didn't have to be shipped, we just picked them up in our truck. Perfect idea. This site also had some bad ideas. One of the interesting ones in a in kind of a sad way, was they were recommending organic soil, which is kind of not something you can really buy, because they were saying that this is the stuff you buy is potting soil. Well, potting soil really isn't soil at all. It's organic matter, but it's not soil. It doesn't have clay in it or sand or silt. It just has a lot of organic matter. So it's really not soil. It's not sustainable because it's organic and it's going to break down. The other thing that bothers me about it is that it's packaged, and a lot of it comes from someplace else in the country, which means it's stuck on a truck and shipped off. So I would recommend really using local products, and if you can avoid the packaging, it's even better. Another not so great idea was buying a book called Carrots Love Tomatoes. Now, this sounds really cute, but cute and science sometimes don't go together very well. And what this does is it kind of takes polyculture to what I call the woo-woo level. And it's the level that's not really supported by science. It sounds good, but it really doesn't make sense from a scientific perspective. And actually, when it's been tested, it doesn't make sense at all. So it's interesting to read, but it certainly isn't anything I would spend a lot of time or money following. And then the last idea there that I'd never heard of before was something called a seed bomb. And I read about this, and it's a handmade product from recycled materials that's packed full of wildflower seeds, and it's kind of shaped like a grenade. And so then what you do is you get it wet and you throw it, and boom, you get all these seeds spread out and they will start growing. Well, that's kind of a cool idea, but then when I looked at their website, it turns out it's actually a website in the United Kingdom, and they're using their native wildflower mix. Well, their native wildflowers are not U.S. native wildflowers, and actually this company is very careful. They do not sell outside their own country for this very reason. But the problem is that this article I read is one that was produced in New York. So it really isn't a very good idea to be recommending a product that's coming from halfway across the world containing seeds from non-native plants. So I would definitely avoid that one. And what about that third part of sustainability? Well, you're going to have to wait until the myth segment to find that one out. Love digging holes in your garden but can't figure out what to plant? Maybe what you should do is consider filling them up with water. Jim Scott, a horticulture PhD, dug into the do's and don'ts of pond building and constructed a wonderful water feature in our small urban landscape. Yes, lucky for me, this pond builder is also my spouse. I visited a little more formally than usual with Jim on a recent afternoon and asked him if all you have to do is just add water.
Obviously, one of the planning parts of it is deciding where you're going to put the pumps and what type of pump you're going to use. I chose an out-of-water pump. You can have submergible pumps or out-of-water pumps. I chose an out-of-water pump simply because they tend to be more energy efficient, and just designing, you know, the laying the piping in.
And part of that piping and then the pump and the filter and all the other little niceties that you have to keep your pond healthy is putting those someplace. And I will say that when Jim first put all of this in, it was pretty darn ugly. We had some holes that were covered up with plastic and really hideous green corrugated something just to keep them from the elements. And then Jim was very clever and built a way to hide them that actually incorporated his way into part of the design of the landscape. So why don't you describe what you did to make me happy in terms of the way it was looking?
Well, yes, Linda didn't like the the aesthetics of the pump house, which was this big, ugly piece of plastic. So I designed a set of small decks, and the smallest deck covers the filter, and then there's a second deck that covers the pump house itself. And then we just threw a third deck on, and I made some systems so the decking, the top of the deck, will cantilever up so you can get access to the filtering system or the pumps when you have to maintain those. But when you don't, you just close down the top of the deck and you can't even tell that they're there.
Jim has a PhD in horticulture. He does not have a degree in engineering or anything like that. And so this is obviously something that you can do on your own without having to have a whole lot of experience. But you have to have patience.
That's right. Patience and just stick with it.
Well, once we got the pond built and everything was running and we fixed the leak that appeared in one of the membranes that's part of this whole system, then we got to the fun part. And the fun part, of course, is adding the live things. And so we have now some pretty well-established plants. We've got some pretty well-established fish.
And we get all kinds of visitors besides those. We have a nesting pair of mallards that come in every year and spend some time here eating Jim's plants as they're appearing at the surface of the pond. We have birds that sit on the rocks by the side of the creek and drink water. We have insects that get, especially bees, that get a lot of their water from here too. So we have a lot of insects and birds and other creatures that like to use this pond. But in terms of picking out the plants that we decided to put in, Jim, how did you figure out what we should use?
Well, I wanted to use plants that would be able to withstand our climate. I mean, we live in Seattle, so it's a pretty mild climate, but still that could tolerate the little cold weather we do get here and would come back to a lot of perennials, so I wouldn't have to keep adding each year plants to the or replanting the pond. And then chose some hardy water lilies. Gives the pond some shade, but also their flowers are attractive. Some rushes and some pickerel weed, just once again, to give it a more of a natural appearance. And also they help take nutrients out of the water to kind of hold algal growth down and just make it a more natural ecosystem. And then we have some submerged plants that we just planted in little pots on the bottom to kind of help oxygenate the water and also for nutrient removal. And, plants to give the fish some protection so that the herons and the raccoons can't find them as easily. You just want to kind of avoid plants that are maybe not native or invasive, because even though you think that it's an isolated pond, as Linda said, we have ducks that fly in and out and some other creatures that come in and out, so those plants have a habit of moving if you're not careful.
Yes, and so if you live in our state, Washington State, you don't want to be putting in water hyacinth, because that's one of those weeds they worry about, weeds of concern. And so depending on where you live, you'll want to check your noxious weed list before you decide what kind of plants to put in. So we do have lots of raccoons around here. We've got herons that fly by, but we haven't lost one fish yet. So what did you do to give the fish some space besides putting in the plants?
When I designed it, I made there's a shelf that goes around the upper part of the pond. It's about 6 inches deep to put in some kind of plants that like shallow water. But then the next shelf drops down pretty steeply to the next depth, so it makes it hard for raccoons to get into the water and get at the fish. The fish can be in the middle of the pond, and the raccoons is just too deep for them. So creating some hiding spots and just planting some plants to give the fish some cover, at least so far, have seemed to protect them from the wildlife in our area.
Well, talking about the fish that we've got in here, we went to great expense to import fish for our pond. We went to the pet store and got, I think, 13 99-cent goldfish. And it was really quite interesting. Of course, here these things have been in a tank and in a pet store all their little lives, and we brought them out here, and all of a sudden they were exposed to the big wide world of this new pond, and they had a great time. They ran around for the first year, then of course they slowed down in the winter and pretty much don't do much at all as long as it's cold. But the neatest thing was that the second year we had them, they started having babies, and so we started having little baby goldfish. They have a great time in the pond. They, of course, get used to people because we feed them, even though they're supposed to be earning their own keep and keeping stuff eaten. They like to get fish food, too, so they come begging for it. So one of the things that, of course, you'd want to make sure you do if you're going to build your own pond in your backyard or front yard or wherever you'd like to have it is doing it legally. And there are usually restrictions to building ponds. And so, Jim, I know that you looked into all that. So what should people do to figure out how to build a pond and if they can?
Essentially, if after a certain depth, I think you have to construct them in areas and protect them as you would a swimming pool, so they're not hazards for young children or something who might fall in one. And so you'd want to certainly check your city's code on, how deep a pond could be before you'd have to fence it in completely or, have it in a backyard that's completely enclosed. But it's kind of, I think, they say just checking with the what the codes are for your city in terms of more the depth of the pond and where it has to be situated, and then making sure that it's situated someplace that you can get easy access to especially electricity, and then some ponds you can put in automatic watering systems that kind of keep the level at a constant height. We didn't do that here because in the winter we get plenty of water from rain and it doesn't evaporate very much.
One of the things that I did to contribute to this project, since Jim was doing most of the heavy work, like digging the hole and carting away the soil, is I figured out what to do for rocks. And rocks can be really expensive. And, of course, you've got to have rocks of all different sizes. You've got to have some on the bottom, helps hold the membrane down in there. And then, of course, along the edge, you have some larger ones. And then you've got large to small ones through your creek bed. And it takes a lot of rock. And what I ended up doing, because as you might know by now, I like to do things very cheaply and as easily as possible, is I went on to both Craigslist and FreeCycle. And I don't think we bought any rock at all. And then with the soil that came out of the hole, which was really quite rocky too, Jim actually built me a sieve, and I sieved all the soil that came out of that hole and got rocks of different sizes. And that's what we used for everything from kind of the pea gravel size up through the different types of pebbles up to the bigger rocks. So not 1 cent was spent on the rocks that surround this pond. Well, I will say that even though we live in a relatively noisy urban environment, we have been listening to planes and cars all the time, that just having the underlying noise of this creek flowing down the pond really makes a huge difference in terms of livability of our front yard.
Every week on this podcast, I look forward to answering some of your gardening questions based on the theme of our show. There are a lot of gardeners out there who want to practice sustainability, but they're bombarded with contradictory information about garden practices and products that promise sustainability. So, sustainability is creating gardens and landscapes that don't require constant inputs of packaged fertilizers and pesticides. I have to tell you, nothing makes me crazier than the myth of instant landscaping. You've seen those home and garden shows before. They're the ones that have this picture-perfect landscaping in a weekend. You start off with dirt, and you end up with this gorgeous flower bed. And in these shows, you get about 50 minutes of clever banter, doing a design, talking to the homeowner, more clever banter. And then you've got 10 minutes when you buy plants, and you dig up the holes, and they look exactly like the container, and you pop the plants out of the container and drop them in the holes, and you scratch some bark mulch on the top, and you're done. Instant landscape. Over a weekend. Now, really, is this going to look this good in a month? Is it going to look this good in a year? I don't think it's going to, and I bet you don't think so either. And many of those plants are going to die a slow, agonizing death because you are watching them die, and you are watching your money wither up with them. So why do these instant landscapes almost always die? Well, the root of the problem is the roots. What I've found in my years as a horticultural CSI specialist, that's a horticultural crime scene investigator, is that tree and shrub roots have a really hard time getting established if they're not planted properly. And the problem with instant landscaping shows is they plant everything the same way you'd plant vegetables or annuals or anything else that you expect to last for about a year. Well, when you're planting trees and shrubs and other permanent plants, you probably want them to last longer than a year, especially if you spent hundreds of dollars on some of these nice trees and shrubs. So the trick with doing sustainable landscapes is to spend a lot of time researching and thinking before you even put a shovel to the soil. So what do you need to do in terms of researching and thinking? Well, we're going to start from the ground up, literally the ground up. First of all, you have to know your soil. You need to know if you've got a sandy soil, a clay soil, a silt soil, and you need to know what nutrients it's got and what organic matter. Don't just play with a black box here. What you need to do is get some soil testing done. Then you've got to figure out your site. Where is it sunny? Where is it shady? Where does the wind come from? Is it cold in one area? Is it wetter in one area? You have to know this first before you plant something that's shade-loving in some place that's going to get 8 hours of full sun in the middle of summer. And know something? I've done that myself. So it's not that we're all perfect. I make more mistakes probably than most people. The third thing you need to do is pick out the right plants. And there's actually two parts to this. Obviously, they have to be the right plants in terms of growing well for your site. But the other thing is they need to be something that pleases you. there's nothing that makes me crazier than garden designers that come in and take their own sense of aesthetics and design and impose them on yours. So in other words, you're planting someone else's fantasy. You're not planting your own. So choose plants that make you happy. Make sure you're doing colors that make you happy and textures that make you happy. Don't rely on someone else to tell you what that is. Then you want to choose healthy plants. When you go to the nursery, you've really got to spend some time looking at the plant up and down. I mean, you're going to be spending your life with this plant, hopefully, and you want to be checking it out. So look at the roots, look at the crown, and make a good, solid, objective decision before you commit to this plant. Plant at the right time of the year. Don't plant in the middle of summer. Even though that's when the plants are available, really hold off and plant when it's going to be a little bit cooler, a little bit moister, and that'll be better for the plants overall. You have to prepare the roots before planting. You can't just pop them and drop them. You've got to take them out. You've got to clean them off. You have to check them out, make sure they're healthy, do a little bit of teasing apart, and get them well situated in the hole. And then the other thing is, you don't put anything in the hole except those roots and the soil that came out of it. You're save yourself money on this one. You're not going to buy all those amendments and fancy fertilizers. You're just using that same old soil that came out, and it's going right back in. Then you've got to water and mulch. That's all you do to keep watering, keep mulching, and keep the weeds out. So it sounds like a really simple list of things to do, and it is simple. But these are the natural ways that plants get established, and you don't have to have all those other products and practices that promise sustainability, because in the long run they don't. All of this planning and researching is going to help you reach sustainability nirvana by creating gardens and landscapes that don't require constant inputs of packaged fertilizers and pesticides. I've got a lot of good science to share with you that supports all of these tips that I listed. You can find it on my webpage, theinformedgardener.com, as free downloadable PDF files. So if you're interested in finding out more science-based information for use in your own garden, I've got some really great resources to give to you. First of all, please visit my webpage, which is theinformedgardener.com. It's my official Washington State University webpage, and it's full of great and free information. Won't cost you a cent. Second, I hope you'll join me and three of my colleagues at the Garden Professors blog, and you can find us at gardenprofessors.com. The four of us take turns every day posting on just about any gardening topic you can think of, and even some that you probably haven't thought of. You can add comments, you can add questions, we always respond to those, and it's really a fun give and take among all of us. And finally, I've also published some books that might be of interest to you. One of them is The Informed Gardener, I mentioned it earlier. There's a sequel to that called The Informed Gardener Blooms Again. And finally, there's a great big book called Sustainable Landscapes and Gardens. And for more information on those books, you can find them on sustainablelandscapesandgardens.com. In any case, I hope you found the podcast entertaining and useful. I really welcome your comments and questions, and you can reach me at lyndacs@wsu.edu.
You've been listening to The Informed Gardener. For more information on Linda's books, future podcasts, and other stories and articles she's written, please visit theinformedgardener.com, thegardenersblog.com, or wsu.edu. Happy gardening!